This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week, I'm going to be dropping some fat beats with We Are Your Friends, also talking about No Escape, Z for Zachariah, Digging for Fire, and the 80s retro homage, Turbo Kid. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, some box office predictions, and of course the world-famous DVD roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies, which also works for Instagram, fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, you can go to twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news I want to hit is the fact that America Ultra bombed, and it bombed pretty hard. We all knew that these movies were not going to do well that opened last week because it's August. Movies that get released in August, particularly late August, tend to not do well. They're very soft at the box office. And in fact, once you get into like September, the box office numbers are really, really low. I mean, sometimes there are movies that top the box office with 10 million or less, although that hasn't happened too recently. In particular, American Ultra bombed worse than Sinister 2 and Hitman, Agent 47. Now, that's not a big surprise that it didn't do as well as Sinister 2, because that at least had a little bit of critic-proofness, being a horror movie. But Hitman, Agent 47 was a sequel nobody was asking for, and people I don't even think were aware was coming out. Yet it did much better than American Ultra. And as a result, Max Landis, the writer, went on a tear on Twitter complaining about the fact that this movie did not do well. Now, I'm not going to read a transcript of what he said. If you want to, you can go to either his Twitter feed or just search Max Landis Twitter and you'll get a news story. And it'll have the entire rant up there for you. But ultimately, he was bemoaning the fact that it was the only quote unquote original movie at the box office. And that, of course, spawned a lot of people saying, why did this do so poorly? And if you go back to last week's show, I think I made a very salient point in saying that at its heart, it's a stoner movie. And stoner movies don't do well in the theaters. They just don't. Because, whether you like it or not, the stoner population in this country is relatively small. So you cannot use Facebook and comment boards on news stories as a gauge to how many people regularly smoke pot. Because I actually think it's relatively low in terms of like the stoner culture. It's a small segment of our population. These people tend to not get off the couch to go to movies. They're not going to fight a crowd. They'll wait till it comes out on DVD or Blu-ray or even streaming, or they'll just pirate it, which is very popular now as well. And in that, if you go and you look at the early posters of American Ultra, there's no sense that it's anything but a stoner movie. There's just Kristen Stewart or Jesse Eisenberg blowing smoke in the air. There is no more to the plot, anything else of like this CIA underground agent, which is what makes the movie unique a little bit. And I think that that was a problem. Now, one of the other things that he complained about was Kristen Stewart has opened huge movies and Jesse Eisenberg's a big movie star. Look, neither of these people are draws. Their name or face on the poster is not going to bring a lot of butts into the seats. Case in point with Jesse Eisenberg, he's got The End of the Tour out in theaters right now. And it's hardly bringing in huge crowds, and arguably both him and Jason Segel are movie stars. Kristen Stewart's only a movie star when it comes to Twilight. If she's not in a Twilight movie, nobody cares. These are not movie stars in the sense that they're going to put butts in the seat. These are not people like Will Smith or Tom Cruise back in the day. But finally, one of the things that Landis complained about was this was the only original movie. And here's the problem with the use of that word. What a Hollywood screenwriter defines as original is not what an audience member defines as original. An audience member defines as original a movie that's not a sequel or reboot, sure, but they'll also say it's something different and something unique. An original screenplay to a Hollywood screenwriter is a screenplay that's wholly their own, something they did not take from existing source material. But there's a lot of movies that people would say, wow, this is a really unique movie, like Road to Perdition, which is actually not an original story. It's drawn from a graphic novel. the use of the word original is jargon, really, when he's complaining about that. I don't think there's very many people out there in the audiences that are saying, I want to see a movie that doesn't come from an existing source, ergo, I want to see an original movie. There's a lot of people say, I want to see an original movie that's different. I mean, something like Guardians of the Galaxy last year is totally based on a comic book, but it's very original, it's very different, and I think that's what helped propel it to such heights last year. So ultimately, Max Landis just needs to chill out a little bit. He's just a little bit butthurt because the critics, and I hate to tell you, also the audiences, because they didn't go see it, rejected his movie because it's really not that original. It's just Jason Bourne on pot. Couple other little pieces of news that are coming out. The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies. I normally would cover this in the DVD roundup, but this is worth mentioning. In November 17th, and you can get it early on demand in October, they're coming out with the extended edition, and the reason that's important, because they've done every Lord of the Rings movies, has had some sort of extended edition out there. What's interesting about this one is it's 20 minutes of extra footage, and it's going to be rated R, which I think is kind of cool, actually. I'm a big fan of the Hobbit movies, and I don't think those should have been rated R in the theater, but I'm curious to see what Peter Jackson puts in, because that's a violent movie, and I'm curious to see how this one's different. There's a couple rumors going around with Man of Steel 2, including George Miller directing, which I think would be kind of cool. He's the guy who directed Mad Max Fury Road. That's a fun movie, and it's visually stimulating, and it's not that dour look that Man of Steel had. I like the fact that George Miller could bring some vibrancy, at least imagery, to this, if he does it. I mean, that's just rumor at this point. But here's a bigger issue. I thought Man of Steel 2 was Batman versus Superman. This is just another piece of evidence that Warner Brothers is still flying by the seat of their pants and back-ending the cinematic universe into a single movie that was released. Remember, there's been exactly one movie in this series released, and it wasn't even planned as launching the cinematic universe. And then finally, a little piece of news I think is interesting. Some people are predicting a $300 million weekend from Star Wars The Force Awakens domestically and like over $600 million overseas. I think that's a little bit much. And here's why. It has everything to do with its release schedule. If you look at the movies that come out in December, they tend to do well, but they're never record-breaking weekends. I think the biggest one is The Hobbit, the first Hobbit movie. It was like $84 million for its weekend, which is huge for December, but that's nothing compared to the stuff in June and May, the $200 million weekends. If Star Wars were coming out first weekend of May, yeah, I think that's a chance. But it's still, you're talking about, it has to best the best by 50%. I love Star Wars, but I still think that's a bit of a bold prediction. I mean, it's still going to make record money when it's all said and done and through the box office, just not $600 million globally on its opening weekend, especially right before Christmas. People are busy at Christmas. That's why those movies don't have the $200 million opening weekends around Christmas, is because there's so much other stuff going on and there's less time to spend in the theaters. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first movie I want to talk about is Burnt. It opens on October 23rd, and it stars Bradley Cooper as a chef.
I don't want my restaurant to be a place where you come and eat. I want people to sit at that table and be sick with longing.
So, where you been?
Louisiana.
Doing what?
Sniffing, snorting, injecting.
If you try to start a new restaurant, there are at least a dozen people who will try to have you killed.
The kitchen's the only place I've ever felt like I really belonged.
This is such an odd trailer to me because it's trying to make the world of culinary arts this cutthroat gangster-type world. I don't watch Kitchen Nightmares. I don't watch that nonsense on reality TV because I think it's garbage. But I realize that there's a lot of drama that happens behind the scenes at a professional kitchen. I don't know if it's this dramatic. I think this is like really just trying to oversell the point. It's an Oscar bid, I think, but coming out in mid-October, this, I think, is one of those Weinstein movies that's just going to get lost in the shuffle. The next movie I want to talk about is The Witch, which opens January 27th.
You've cursed this family.
Come and get it!
Who's there?
This is the evil of the wood.
Now, this was a big hit at Sundance, and it looks scary as all get out. This looks like a very atmospheric movie. Now, it's opening in January, and that doesn't necessarily mean it's bad, because horror movies can do very well in January. And it's nice to see a horror movie that's not just some found footage nonsense dropping in January. Now, it's late January, but still, don't know much about it, but it certainly looks atmospheric and scary, and that's what I want to see. It looks like a neat original type of movie that I'm looking forward to. That's it for the Trailer Park. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about We Are Your Friends and Z for Zachariah. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing on with the show and hitting off with the movie reviews. Let's start off by, like I said, dropping some fat beats. I'm bringing the fat. I'm expecting Zac Efron to bring the beats. And I'm going to be talking about We Are Your Friends. A DJ from the Valley flirts with fame as he tries to make a living for himself and navigate a social life in Los Angeles.
Hi, hi, howdy, howdy, hi, hi.
You're James Reed, right?
You could call me Multiply.
Spin here regularly?
Yeah.
Hey, babe.
No.
What are you doing Saturday?
Anything less than...
I'll see you Saturday.
Just get the bird, more like an eagle.
You can make people dance, and that's half the battle.
James thinks you're really talented.
Sounds have soul. Build them from scratch. You're not going to get anywhere using the same old sounds that every other laptop DJ uses.
Don't you feel like there's a lot more quality stuff we could be doing?
This was one of those movies that I started to see advertised in the summer. And there are two things that I'll see in trailers that strike fear in my heart. And one of them is opening this fall, and the other one is opening this January. Because those tend to be bad times for movies. And kudos to Warner Brothers for screening this, because they have some confidence in it, which is good. I mean, I don't think this is a big movie. I really don't know how many people are seeing it. It's an appropriate release, at least for this time of year. It's sort of like a get back to school kind of release where, you know, the teenagers and the 20-somethings can go check it out. It's not something that would compete ever with like Jurassic World or The Force Awakens when it comes out in December. I was dreading this movie simply because it is a movie that I have zero interest in. When I was younger, you know, in my 20s, I went to a couple dance clubs. My sister took me to a couple dance clubs when I was in college. I hated every freaking minute of that. I do not like going to clubs. I don't particularly like going to concerts for that matter because they're so loud. And I said, oh no, I sound like an old man, but I was thinking that when I was like a teenager, if it's so loud, you can't hear the sound. It's not appealing to me. I saw Pink Floyd at the Ohio State University and it was a very good show, but it was so loud. I couldn't even process the sound and it did become noise. And that's the way I've always been. So the idea of going to a dance club to me would be one of the worst things that you could do to me. I mean, if I came home and somebody says, hey, we got passes to this great new party and it's at this dance club, you want to go? I'd be like, no, absolutely not. This sounds like a horrible experience. I'm not into DJing. I know people that are DJs and they're, you know, that's their passion and that's great. It's not something I'm interested in at all. So with that, I went in this movie hoping that it would be short and merciful and wouldn't make me hate the experience. I gotta say, I didn't hate it. And that's a glowing response from me because this kind of dance club movie is exactly the kind of thing that I would dread seeing. I wasn't a fan. I didn't think it was a particularly good movie, but that's mainly because I had zero interest in anything happening in it. I wasn't interested in Zac Efron's character. The hot model, Emily Ratajkowski, she's pretty enough, and she's got fantastic breasts, don't get me wrong. She looks great. But this is the third movie I've seen her in, from Gone Girl, and then she was, what, in Entourage this summer? I'm not terribly impressed with her as an actor. She's exactly what you'd expect from this model turned actress who wants to make it big, and she's essentially playing a version of herself. And there might be a great actress in there somewhere, but you don't see it in this movie. She's a pretty face. Zac Efron's good. I mean, he's leading man material. He just needs better projects. He needs a little bit more of a mature role. This is just a version of Troy from High School Musical again. But ultimately, it's a well-shot movie. It's a well-acted movie for the most part. I didn't hate things that were happening in it. I didn't absolutely hate the characters. There are some characters that are not very good characters, but at least they serve a purpose. And it's a little heavy-handed with its message to this DJ of doing your own thing and making your mark on the world and being creative. Ironically, it gives this big lecture in the movie about how to be creative and not just put out something that everybody else is putting out. While at the same time, the movie is putting out something that everybody else puts out when it comes to, you know, make it yourself kind of movie. It's just looking at it through a DJ perspective. I mean, this is essentially the character is Anna Kendrick's character from Pitch Perfect without the a cappella group. Now, I didn't particularly like it, but like I said, I didn't hate it. And so I give it a little bit of respect. I'm still going to say it kind of sucks, because it's not that good of a movie. But, you know, if you are into this sort of thing, if you really love Zac Efron or you are into the club scene, you might enjoy it. But for an old fart like me, it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Z for Zachariah. This is a smaller release. It's getting sort of this limited run. This really hit my radar a little bit ago because the temptation is to take Margot Robbie, who's just absolutely gorgeous, and put her in the ugly drab role. But she is so beautiful, it's impossible to make her look ugly and drab. So she's still gorgeous in the context of a post-apocalyptic world. But see, that's not what the movie's about. It's not just there to give her an acting platform and for people to be surprised that she can look drab. So in the movie, after the collapse of civilization, a lone woman survives in a protected valley until two separate and mysterious strangers stumble into her life.
I didn't see anyone alive for over a year. My dad told us he can't leave the valley. As long as we stay here, we'd be protected.
I mean you no harm, man.
This guy could be anybody for all we know.
This valley survived like you and I did because we have faith. So what's your plan?
The most impressive thing about this movie is the cast. In particular, Chiwetel Ejiofor, who is best known now by people as the star from 12 Years a Slave, he brings a lot of gravitas to this movie that Margot Robbie holds up. Margot Robbie is a beautiful woman, but she's also a really good actress. And I've said this before, she's almost too beautiful to make it as a movie star, but I think she's just good enough of an actress to get past that. Not that she has to make herself look drab and ugly, but she's a good enough actress that you can put her up against a great actor like Chiwetel Ejiofor, and she holds her own. And that's not easy to do. Now, Chiwetel Ejiofor plays a guy who wanders into the valley, and she sort of saves him from being radiation poisoned. But they work together, and they work together pretty well. And then you throw in Chris Pine, who's not a great actor, but again, he's sort of like the male version of Margot Robbie. He's very attractive. He's a movie star, but I don't know if he's somebody that you can put on a movie poster and people are going to go see. I think that was proved by Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit last year. Nobody cared that he was in it. He is just another pretty face, but he's a good enough actor that he can hold his own. I think he's the least of the three, though. He plays essentially the threat to Chiwetel Ejiofor's character as the young, attractive guy who then comes in and changes this dynamic. And she goes from not having seen a human being in a year to having two of them on her doorstep. And it's how she deals with it and how they're dealing with her and how they're dealing with her baggage that she has. And there's some neat stuff. What I like about it, it's not a zombie movie. I thought it was a zombie movie with Z in the title and a post-apocalyptic thing. I'm like, oh, another zombie movie. It's going to be The Walking Dead in theaters. And it's not, which is cool because I think that we're sort of zombied out right now. This one is just a standard post-apocalyptic world, and it's a character study and this interaction of these three people. It's a slow burn. It's not a lickety-split action film, but it has a lot of stuff to contemplate, and it's a much more somber, thoughtful piece than an action piece. And that's okay, because we need that now and then. And it's nice that it's coming out now, because in about 2 or 3 months, you're going to have so many thoughtful, dramatic pieces, you're not going to want to see them. And that's why you're going to want to watch stuff like The Hobbit, the extended edition, and R-rated glory. So anyway, Z for Zachariah kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. When I come back, more movie reviews with No Escape and Digging for Fire.
Oppan Gangnam Style.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. Continuing with the movie reviews, let's talk about No Escape. It opened on Wednesday. I haven't seen a lot of Wednesday openings this year. 2 years ago, in like 2013, there were a ton of movies that just opened on Wednesday. Some of them were kids' movies, some of them were grown-up movies. A lot of times they'll release a movie on Wednesday if they're afraid that what's happening during the weekend is going to gobble up all of its box office. And that makes sense for movies that came out in the summer. Entourage did that. I forget what it opened against. They were hoping to kind of get a bump in the box office before the Friday openings, but that was in like June. No Escape opened in late August on a Wednesday, and its only other wide release it's going up against is We Are Your Friends. It's by the Weinstein Companies, and the Weinsteins, for as much as people say they're geniuses in marketing, they sometimes make some huge blunders in getting their films out there for people to see, unless it's like the one or two movies that they're pushing to win the Oscar, like The Artist or The King's Speech or something like that. Anyways, in No Escape, a family moves to a poverty-stricken Southeast Asian country on the eve of a revolution and find themselves hunted as foreigners.
10 years ago, I could not have pictured myself dragging my family to the other side of the world to start over.
What if we don't like it here?
I think we will.
Welcome to Asia. You're gonna love it here.
What did you see outside?
Get your hands off me!
There's like a war going on out there. We're gonna die here.
This movie, it was inspired by movies like Taken, and apparently it spent years in development, and they changed stars, and they kept that having to kept changing the script. So this has gone through a lot of iterations. It ended up with Owen Wilson as the father, and Lake Bell as the mother, and then of course it was Pierce Brosnan as this kind of mysterious guy who ends up kind of helping them out during this really dangerous time. And it's harrowing and it's dangerous and it's impossible to watch this, especially as a parent and a husband, without putting yourself in the situation. Now, my kids are all boys, so I don't have girls, but you can imagine going to a country and having to save your kids, especially when you're being hunted specifically because you're foreigners. And it's Owen Wilson and Lake Bell. And they don't mention what country it is. Assuming it's like Cambodia or Laos or a fake country that's representing Cambodia and Laos. I think it's being banned in Cambodia because of some way they wrote the police words on their uniforms or something like that. I don't know. I don't know exactly why. I'm not into the politics of that region. But let's just call this country Southeast Asia-ish land. And Owen Wilson, as a 6'2", blonde, white guy, does not quite blend into Southeast Asia-ish land very well. The push of the movie is these rebels are killing foreigners, particularly Americans, and they're zeroing in on him because he's involved in the company that is sort of is what the spark that started this revolution. So it's harrowing, and you know that they're being targeted. Its biggest problems come when it just gets a little too Hollywood-ish. There's a scene in there where things are almost lost, and then a very Hollywood thing happens, and they get saved. And I remember watching that and going, well, this went from being somewhat of a realistic, terrifying, what-would-you-do thriller to just being another crappy Hollywood movie. It just didn't seem to work in this context. But even more so, I had the hardest time swallowing the pill of this movie because I could not get past the premise. I went to Israel last year by myself for like a week and a half. And before I went, I talked to people who'd been there. I read about the State Department just to see if there's any warnings in particular about the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. As there was tensions building in the Gaza Strip, I kept my eye on it, and I was talking to my contact there saying, hey, what's going on here? What's happening with the security in Jerusalem? And I did not go in cold, and I was just going by myself. In this movie, this guy moves to a totally different country that's, as they actually call it in this movie, the fourth world. Now, it's not the fourth world if you talk about nomadic tribes and indigenous people, which is really what the fourth world is, but it's like so bad it's not even third world. It's really bad. And he flies his whole family sight unseen. He'd never been here, doesn't know anything about the culture, the location, or anything, doesn't know where the American embassy is, doesn't know anything about the safety or security of the actual place, and he moves his family there. Why doesn't he just move out there, live there for a month, and then after he gets a lay of the land and figures out what's going on and says, hey, this is safe, then you move your family over? It was such a bizarre thing to swallow. I mean, you're really going in blind. He didn't even know where the American embassy was. If I were traveling to a country like that, I would know where my hotel was. I'd know where the American embassy was. I'd be sure that I could speak to people. This was not a smart move on his part. So there's a whole string of idiot moves and stupid decisions to get in this situation yourself. It would be like making a movie about a person who's kidnapped by drug dealers in the worst area of Mexico, for example. Why would you be traveling to the worst area of Mexico? It's one thing if you're going to Tijuana with your buddies and you get kidnapped and taken down there. That's at least a good thing. But you don't bring your family to the worst place, drug lord infested area of Mexico, and then be surprised if somebody's trying to kill you. And then the movie gets to a misery porn level where you're just, it seems so grim and terrible. It just, I don't know what the purpose of making the movie was. Oh yeah, it's trying for the human spirit and can you survive? But it's just so awful, some of the things that happen or could potentially happen. It's unpleasant to watch. And that's my problem. I mean, yeah, it's going to touch you if you're a parent. You're going to be like, oh my gosh, what if they did that to my kid? But it's also such a horrible thing that it's not entertaining in any way. So I'm going to have to say that No Escape, while well acted, it just didn't appeal to me. So I'm going to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Digging for Fire. This one is Joe Swansburg's movie. He directed Drinking Buddies, and he was in movies like You're Next, which I loved. Now, he's sort of this mumblecore pioneer. It stars Jake Johnson and Rosemary DeWitt as a married couple struggling with their stagnating relationship and the pressure of being parents over a long weekend apart.
Look what I found on the hill.
My guess is it's an animal bone and there just happened to be...
Some other animal shot it.
Yeah.
Hi, Mom.
Just thinking about coming down.
I just need a break.
Why isn't Daddy?
Sometimes mommies want daddies to pitch in, and if you don't, mommy comes after you and goes... Rawr.
Well, let's keep digging.
I think we're going to just sort of hang here.
I'm in.
If you don't want to dig, how about some hookers?
No, it's a sort of illogical jump you just made.
I've gone on record before to say I'm not a big fan of mumblecore because I think the dangers of mumblecore is you try to talk through too much. The banter does not appear real. And that's because they're actors trying to sound real as opposed to just becoming the characters and being real. There's a little bit of that happening in this movie. Jake Johnson, I think, doesn't do that, but he draws that out of people. I saw that with him and Olivia Wilde in Drinking Buddies, and I also see that with him and Rosemary DeWitt in this movie. There's this weird ersatz presence in their talk with each other. Once they separate in the movie and are doing different things, it gets a lot better and it gets a lot more natural. So I think maybe it's just the way Jake Johnson interacts with the people he is with. The other guys that he works with in the movie, because it's him with this long weekend with these buddies come over, they overtalk a little too much. And you've got Brie Larson and Anna Kendrick show up at one point, and Anna Kendrick's very minor in this movie. But it's an okay film. What's interesting about it is it's a story about the guy. He finds what he thinks is a dead body buried deep, deep, deep in the ground next to the house. They're basically house sitting. And his wife's like, oh, don't worry about it. And then she goes off to visit her parents. And her parents are awful people who are trying to get her to break up. And it's a story we've seen before where they're each finding somebody that they might have a connection with, possibly have an affair. Rosemarie DeWitt runs into Orlando Bloom, and Jake Johnson kind of strikes up something with Brie Larson, and there's a will they or won't they, you know, is there going to be infidelity here, which is interesting. And then the whole buried dead body becomes a metaphor for searching for something, and it's fun to search, but then when it becomes real, do you want to actually dig up that dead body? Or do you want to retreat, cover it back up, and say, I don't want that kind of drama in my life? And I think that's the most interesting part. It's a bit heavy-handed that way, but it's still an interesting approach to an infidelity movie, which is much better than Rosemarie DeWitt's other infidelity movie, Men, Women, and Children, which was terrible. Ultimately, I'm going to say that Digging for Fire, because it has some interesting things going on, I think it's an interesting approach, it just barely kind of rocks for me. But if you like the mumblecore stuff, if you love drinking buddies, you're going to love this movie. But for me, it just kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the final movie, Turbo Kid, and then, of course, the box office winners and the DVD roundup. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr finishing up Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's continue with the movie reviews. One final film to talk about, and that is Turbo Kid. In post-apocalyptic 1997, a lone teenager assumes the identity of a comic book hero to fight an evil overlord.
I will destroy you with my Turbo Glove, the ultimate weapon against the robot threat.
What's that in your hand?
It's a comic book.
What's it about?
It's about a Turbo Rider.
This is gonna get ugly.
As you may know, the situation is critical. We have reached maximum casualty level.
Who exactly are you supposed to be?
Turbo Rider.
This is it, soldier. We have to hit these sand machines with everything we've got.
Find them, kill them, and lead back their heads on pikes.
I grew up in the 80s, so this immediately touches me as a film goer. These were the kind of movies I saw at these all-night movie marathons, but I remember seeing these movies in the theater. Not everybody did. A lot of these were direct-to-video movies, these sort of post-apocalyptic things. It's always cheap to do post-apocalyptic because you're in L.A., you could just go out to the desert and you can just shoot with nothing in the background as long as you didn't catch a plane flying overhead or something like that. Or sometimes you did, and that was part of the joy of these just really kind of terrible B movies, but there's a certain fun element to them. They are a remnant of an era and a remnant of a genre that seemed to disappear in the 90s. I mean, we still have post-apocalyptic movies, but they kind of changed. This weirdly optimistic yet still extremely violent post-apocalypse that happened in the movies in the 80s was something I will always remember. These kind of movies would not exist were it not for VHS tape. And, of course, HBO and Showtime. And that's where you saw a lot of this stuff long before the Sci-Fi Channel ever started making their own in the 90s. Stuff like Nights with Kathy Long and stuff like Robot Jocks or Solar Babies, which actually had a big theatrical release in the 80s, or something even like Megaforce just showed up on Riff Trax, did their own version of Megaforce, which isn't quite post-apocalyptic, but it feels that way because it's all shot in the desert and it's all just stuff blowing up. What I love about this movie is it nails the elements of the 1980s. It nails the set design. It nails the artistic title design. It nails the music. The music is, and right now we're having a throwback to music that feels like it comes from the 80s. You saw that in movies like Beyond the Black Rainbow. You saw that with It Follows. I'm seeing it in other movies just cropping up in movies you wouldn't expect. This one authentically is a throwback soundtrack, and they even get a little cheesier with it because it's a homage to these movies from the 80s where you have some kid going up against a warlord in a post-apocalyptic world. And this one, he's a kid whose parents have been killed, and he's on his own, and he befriends a robot, which is a very attractive, cute robot. And he assumes the character of this comic book hero and has this power glove, which again is another throwback to the 80s. Cause you know, a power glove is such an 80s/90s wizard technology that you would never see nowadays. He has this power glove and he's trying to go up against and defeat these overlords. It's a little bit convoluted at times, but that's the way these movies were. Very recently, just last week, I watched Hell Comes to Frogtown, which stars Rowdy Roddy Piper. In one of his few film appearances, his most notable was They Live, which is a fantastic movie, and I saw that as well. But Hell Comes to Frogtown is one of those post-apocalyptic movies. It was made, I think, in 1986, sometime in the late 80s. And it's a terrible movie. I remember explaining the plot to my wife, and she looks at me, she goes, "You're just making this up, aren't you?" And I'm like, no, really, there's mutant frog creatures that are getting this guy to impregnate all the women that are still fertile in the post-apocalyptic land. And as much as Hell Comes to Frogtown is a terrible movie, it's fun to riff and make fun of, but it's not a good film. But Turbo Kid takes all the elements that make Hell Comes to Frogtown fun and actually puts it together in a coherently made movie. This is one that actually they're trying to make a decent film with. Whereas a lot of these films that went direct to video or direct to cable that I caught on VHS, these movies were just stuff that they were just cranking out to fill video shelves. Because you go to the video store, people don't remember this. If you're under 30, you probably don't remember going to the video store in the 80s where it was all VHS tapes. And all the tapes of Batman Returns is taken. But you're at the whim of what's the selection in that video store. And once you get past the new releases, you tend to have mined your movie section of whatever your favorite genre is. If you like horror or science fiction or mystery or comedy. So you end up seeing pretty much everything they had in their selection. That's how I saw a lot of just terrible movies, like Psychos in Love, which was a ridiculously bad horror movie from the 90s. That's how I first saw Troll 2, actually. I couldn't find something worth seeing, so I picked up Troll 2. It was a relatively new release in the early 90s before it became cool to like Troll 2. And that's what makes Turbo Kid work, is it mines all of its material from that last case on the video store shelves, but it's actually fun to watch. And it's very violent and goofy and silly, and it's got Michael Ironside as the bad guy, and he chews the scenery as you expect him to, and he's a throwback to 80s culture as well. So this is a real fun movie, and it's opening in theaters. If you get a chance to see it in theaters, it's a lot of fun. It'd be great with a crowd. Check that one out. Turbo Kid rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Last week I predicted correctly that Straight Outta Compton was going to win again. I think some people were thinking, well, maybe Sinister 2 or American Ultra. Nope. America Ultra did particularly terrible. It did $5.5 million, which is like what Mission Impossible made on Friday. And it's like, what, fourth week of release? Sinister 2 came in third with just over $10 million, and Hitman Agent 47 came in with a little over $8 million, which is terrible as well, but still not as bad as American Ultra. Now, I talked about why American Ultra didn't do very well. Sinister and Hitman were not, well, I think they weren't expecting much from Hitman, but Sinister was a huge step down from the last film, but I think it was also a remnant of it being a sequel, it not being as good, and it was in a different release cycle. It wasn't taking advantage of a vacuum of horror in the summer. It was dumped in the August dumping ground. But Straight Outta Compton held pretty well, dropped less than 60% to $26 million. I said $30 million, so that's pretty close. This week, I think that Straight Outta Compton is going to win again. I really don't think We Are Your Friends or No Escape is going to bring much money. And even if No Escape opened on Friday, I don't think it would beat Straight Outta Compton, because that movie's going to at least make $10 million. I think it's going to be upwards of $13 million for its third week. And so it's going to rule the box office for a third week in a row. And who knows, maybe next week it'll rule again, because it's Labor Day weekend and that's always just a vacuous time for movies. And then I think We Are Your Friends, No Escape. No Escape's going to be way, way, way down, simply because any demand to see it will have been burned off from Tuesday night previews and then Thursday and Friday before the weekend even started. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD Roundup. A couple movies from the theaters is pretty slim, actually. These are two of them are award films that are finally coming out, which seems a little late for award films to come out. The first one's 2 Days, One Night, which Marion Cotillard was nominated for a bunch of awards for this one. It's a French movie about a woman who is in a factory and she's going to get laid off. And the only way to not get laid off is to convince people who she works with to mitigate their bonuses and salaries to allow her to stay on. And she's got to get people to vote for her. And it's over the course of 2 days of her trying to get people to say, hey, yeah, you can keep your job. It's a depressing movie. It's very French. I thought it was okay. I thought it was a little overrated. And by little, I mean a lot. There's also Citizen Four, which is a really interesting movie, especially with what's been going on with the Ashley Madison hack in a weird way. Ashley Madison is all about sex and cheating, but it's a great example of how no data is private anymore. And Citizen Four tells the story of Edward Snowden and how he broke the story about how the NSA is looking at your stuff. And yeah, sure, Ashley Madison isn't about that, but it shows that once something goes on a network, it's there and it's readable and its data can be crunched. And it's accessible to people to get into it. And in Citizen Four, it's the government just going in and taking the data. And it's a revelation of what actually happened and how the story was broken. So it's a very interesting story. Even if you think what Edward Snowden did was a terrible thing, it's interesting to watch to see how this all played out in the process, because it goes back to them interviewing him. There's also Lila and Eve, which I talked about a couple weeks ago. In limited release, it's about Viola Davis and Jennifer Lopez as mothers who are taking revenge on the people they think have killed their kids. Animals is also out, which is a movie about drug addiction. It's told by David Nachmanian, who was in The Dark Knight, and he was also in Ant-Man. He used to be a drug addict, and it's a little bit autobiographical. Definitely worth checking out. And then finally on TV, there's The Walking Dead Season 5. I'm not a big fan of The Walking Dead. I could care less about Fear of the Walking Dead, because I'm sure it's the same thing. It's going to be a bunch of people sitting around talking and not bathing. But season 5 is available if you want to see that. There's Revenge Season 4, the TV show on ABC about, well, it's about revenge. Elementary Season 3 with Johnny Lee Miller as Sherlock Holmes and Lucy Liu as Watson. And then finally, The Mindy Project Season 3, the last time you get to see The Mindy Project until it goes on to Hulu, which means it's the last time I'm going to see The Mindy Project, because I've always rejected Hulu because it's all ads, even if you pay for the service, and I don't particularly care to pay for ads. So I think they're supposedly changing that, but I don't like The Mindy Project enough to get Hulu. Maybe when I finally need to watch some more classic Doctor Who, I think that's where they have most of the episodes. But the fourth season of The Mindy Project, when it airs on Hulu, is not enough to draw me in. That's it for this week. Next week, I'll be talking about the big Labor Day movies, The Transporter Refueled, and A Walk in the Woods. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.